The historical context. The naval engagement in the Bay of Biscay. Distress and Kerlog rescue, 28th to 29th December 1943. The Maritime Institute of Ireland, on the 27th of May 1994, inaugurated the Kerlog commemorative exhibition in Dunleary. It marked the 50th anniversary of the rescue of 168 German Navy personnel by the Irish merchant vessel Kerlog on December 29, 1943. The exhibition was opened by the President of Ireland, Mary Robinson. Later in the year, it was shown in Dungarvan and Waterford. In this way, the Kerlog story became known to many people in Ireland interested in maritime history. The Institute, through the German Embassy and German Navy authorities, had invited German Navy veterans interned in Ireland from 1944 to 1945. 15 veterans were able to take up the invitation and travelled to Ireland. A surviving member of the Kerlog crew and two veterans from the English Navy who had served on the British cruisers Glasgow and Enterprise came also to Dunleary. For these visitors, a programme was prepared, including a visit to the Kairos camp's former internment camp and to Dungarvan, where Captain Thomas Donoghue was laid to rest in 1949 at the churchyard of Abbeyside. During their visit to Ireland, the veterans were met everywhere with Irish hospitality. People they met included members of the families of Captain Donoghue and other crew members, friends of the Maritime Institute and the Irish Armed Forces. During these meetings, stories were exchanged about the Kerlog rescue and the time of internment in Ireland. Quite a few questions also were asked of what happened to the German destroyers and torpedo boats and their crews before and after their engagements with the English cruisers. However, time available was too short to tell the story. Little has been published on what happened during the naval engagement on December 28, 1943. The encounter did not rank important in naval history. Furthermore, the survivors, many rescued by the Kerlog, others by German submarines and British and Spanish naval units, disappeared in post-war Germany. In fact, it was only 48 years after the event that efforts were made by some former Navy cadets to find their comrades and to arrange a meeting. At that time, it was learned that two of the cadets had written down their account of the December 1943 events soon after the rescue. Two other former cadets, Werner Krüger from Z-27 and Dieter Peinert from T-27, published a detailed account of what happened. Their report is based on research of German naval documents, information gathered from veterans, and their own memory. The report is called Bernau und Trave, a review. It covers the joint operations of the 8th destroyer and the 4th torpedo boat flotillas for the escort of two blockade runners from Japan through the Bay of Biscay to the German occupied port of Bordeaux. These blockade runners were codenamed Bernau, the ship's name was Ozono, and Trave, the ship's name was Alsterufer. The operation Bernau succeeded, Trave failed. The Krüger-Peinert report of December 1993 was written for their families and friends. It was dedicated to their Navy comrades who died at sea. My short report now is based on memory, refreshed by the above-mentioned reports, and was written for my Irish friends. It reflects events which happened 51 years ago when I was an 18-year-old naval cadet. Operation Bernau. Around Christmas 1943, to be precise, 23rd to 26th of December, the 8th destroyer and 4th torpedo boat flotillas, coming from the ports of Bordeaux and Brest respectively, met during the morning of the 24th of December. They proceeded together to the pre-arranged meeting point. The point was reached at midday and the Ozzano met a little later. We had stormy weather during the whole operation. Both flotillas were detected by the British air reconnaissance early and raided frequently by Liberator and Halifax bombers. While there were a number of close calls, none of the boats were seriously damaged. However, because of heavy seas, Z-23 sprang a leak and lost 4 men, who were swept off the gun deck. In spite of the young and relatively untrained crew, the flotilla reached their respective ports safely in the early morning hours of 26 December. The Ozzano, however, while already in the Gironde River on her way to Bordeaux, struck a wreck. She sprung a leak and took water rapidly. The skipper managed to beach her immediately and the cargo was safe completely. After the Operation Bernau, there was not much time for rest or sleep. Oil, water, ammunition had to be replenished and the ships repaired from sea damage. All port watches also had to be operated. It was in fact late evening when finally part of the crew was released to get some sleep. Operation Trave. Before dawn on the 27th of December, the destroyers and torpedo boats made up steam and left port again. They were to meet the second blockade runner on its way home from the Far East. Z-27, as during the previous operation, had the commander of the destroyer flotilla on board. He was in charge of the whole operation. His staff and some Air Force personnel who also boarded and had to be accommodated, bringing total number of men on board to about 340. The Air Force group, called B Service, provided service to decode English and US communications. My own duty station was on the bridge with my mate Hans Helmut Karsch. We were on the ultra shortwave telephone for communication to the boats of the flotilla, or alternatively on the telephone for orders to the anti-aircraft gun decks. Both of us had to follow the commander and the captain to relay their orders. The weather was stormy and the ships headed westwards, reducing speed as required. The personnel on deck and on the bridge were constantly wet because of the spray, and everything was covered by salt. Close lookout was held for approaching aircraft, but none showed up during the first day and the night. From our past experience, this was unusual, but of course we hoped that no one had spotted us. All of the time we were on duty station, but not under full alert. Everyone was either on lookout or dozed, depending on what was on watch. The boat rolling, stamping and shuddering at speed made real sleep impossible. Commander and captain were standing on the bridge, exposed to weather and to sea as everybody else. Once in a while, the Luftwaffe personnel provided information on enemy communication. When the two officers put their heads together, Karsch and I wondered what was going on, but a clear picture apparently did never evolve. Around AM on the 28th, an English aircraft was spotted. It flew, however, outside our range of guns, apparently carrying on watching duties. While wind and seas were still strong, the sun had come through the clouds. We were feeling warmer by the looks of it, and put the long night behind us. Of course, we wondered what was coming. Soon, news was out that we would reach meeting point at 10 a.m. We hoped then that we would meet the Ulster Ufa and guide them home safely. When she did not turn up, the boats fanned out to search for her. The ship steaming at starboard and port of us made a lovely sight. For 2 hours we searched in vain. The Ulster Ufa never showed up. As Kruger and Peinert in their report stated, on the 27th of December, the Ulster Ufa had been identified by a Sunderland plane, just a day's trip from the meeting point and Navy escort. Now she had been made out as a target. From 1 p.m. onward, she was attacked by British bombers and sunk at 6 p.m. It is not clear if her messages or those of the attackers had been received and evaluated at the German Navy operational staff. The overall situation at this time was rather unclear to the commander. He had to assume that the Ulster Ufa was lost. At noontime, therefore, the flotillas were ordered to turn east and to head home. About half an hour later, a German search plane detected the British cruisers Glasgow and Enterprise. They were coming up from a northeasterly position. When the presence of the cruisers was announced, everyone was wide awake. Orders were dispatched from the commander to all boats to fall into a new formation. The order to keep heading east was repeated. It was around 1:30 p.m. when the British crews were first spotted. Our destroyer, leading a group of 5 boats, turned around to take them on, as the main weapons of destroyers and torpedo boats were torpedoes. We had to close in. Soon destroyers and cruisers opened fire from their heavy guns, and there were noise and smoke everywhere. When we fired our torpedoes, they were accompanied by good wishes, but all of them failed to reach their target. The English guns soon had targeted in on us, and yellowish fountains sprang up around the boat. As Karsh and I had to be alert to dispatch orders, there was no time to be afraid. I never noticed any hit. However, when the ship slowed down and we were blowing a fog screen, it became clear that something had gone wrong. In fact, one shell had hit the engine room. The superheated steam lines had burst, leaving havoc in the engine room. There was no chance to resume operation. Soon the fog drifted away and we were lying still. The cruisers drew closer in spite of our gunfire. Z-23, a destroyer standing near to us, offered to take us over. Because of the wind and the high seas, the commander did not accept this risk and ordered Z-23 to head home. Then the decision was taken that the crew, with the exception of those manning guns, should abandon the ship. We passed on the order and bid farewell and good luck to the other boats. After that, Karsh and I found ourselves alone on the bridge with the captain. He ordered us to head for life rafts, shook hands and wished us good luck. First, we stepped down from the bridge on port side and made for the lower deck. Here we saw that many of the crew had already abandoned ship and that no rafts were available anymore. We then decided to head for the upper deck on starboard, where we expected rafts to be available. On our way, we met another sailor known to us who followed us to the upper deck. Close to the front gun on starboard, we located a raft which hung on the side of the bridge. We worked on it to get it out of its support, which was rather difficult. When we had succeeded, our front gun fired directly over our heads. We were totally deafened, somewhat shocked, but otherwise okay. Then we hurried, dropped the raft into water and jumped after it. It was quite a distance, 18 feet. But we jumped without hesitation because the raft started to drift. I had forgotten to fill up my life vest, but that did not matter. With a few strokes, I reached the raft and pulled myself up, and so did the others. We drifted towards a large number of other rafts. On our way, we picked up one sailor swimming in the water. When we reached the other rafts, we were asked to take on two more men, as some of the rafts were overcrowded. With six men now, we were deeper in the water, sitting in it up to the waist. The cruisers moved closer still, and our destroyer kept firing. Fountains came up right between the rafts. Everything seemed to be like a movie. There was our destroyer starting listing. The sea in turmoil, the blast of guns, and the danger of direct hits. We seemed to be strangely not involved. Finally, the guns of our boat fell silent. The ship rolled over and started sinking fast. Stern first, it went down with the bows showing against the sky. Three hurrahs sounded across the sea as a last farewell. Then we were alone and everything was quiet. Thank God the water was not icy. How cold it was, we never learned. Soon we realized that we were drifting in a current, sometimes moving slow, then again fast. We also had to balance the raft in the sea. We all felt that it would be prudent to keep the rafts together and tied them up with ropes. All feared to be on their own and hoped that a large number of rafts was easier to see. However, tying the rafts together proved a mistake, as we were riding up and down the waves. The rafts banged into each other. Also, the sidelines pulled out and the canvas covers were damaged and started to spill out. We therefore cut the ropes, tied our life vests over the damage and kept long lines to two other rafts in order to avoid these collisions. All this required full attention and kept us occupied. When we noticed that the cruisers were closing in, we thought they would come to our rescue. We reminded each other that we should say then, when questioned, our own name, not that of the ship or the flotillas. We could already make out sailors on board ship when they resumed cruising speed and moved on. First, we could not believe it and had to overcome shock and disappointment. Soon on our raft, a leading seaman took up command. He instinctively had sensed that we should keep ourselves warm by clapping arms, huddling together and slapping each other. He urged all of the time to keep moving and exercise. We soon found out that our emergency rations had been partly plundered. No chocolate, but some biscuits. There were, however, cigarettes and matches, and there was a SOS signalling ammunition with that firing pistol. Having established all this during the fading daylight, we slowly drifted into the winter night. Everywhere SOS signals were going up around us. We could sense that the rafts had drifted apart widely. Luckily, we realized that using SOS ammunition at this time made no sense. With so many stars flaring up, any approaching rescue craft, submarine or whatever, could have located the area well. We also hoped, with all the SOS stars going up around us, that rescue was underway. We did not know at this time that T-25 and T-26 had been sunk, and their crews were also drifting some distance away. We developed some skill balancing the rafts and riding with the waves. The danger was always that once in a while, one wave was different from the other. Our feet rested on the net of canvas stripes about 3 inches apart. A number of times, one of my feet slipped through I then thought of many fathoms of water under me, and fear approached. I only felt safe again when both feet on the canvas. Whenever we had to relieve ourselves, we felt as comfortable and warm. But soon the cold crept in again. The night dragged on endlessly. Each of us developed his own defense system. We thought of rescue ships finding us in the morning, of submarines picking us up, and of course of home. Once in a while, I called Kosh, asking him to keep awake. Sometimes he called me. Our will to survive was very strong that night. This showed when sometimes in the middle of the night, us not being fully alert, our raft capsized. We fell into the water, but immediately got hold of the raft again and pulled ourselves to safety. Five of us did, the sixth man couldn't. He was an NCO from the machine room, not known to us. He probably was not used to cold weather and exposure. His leather suit was heavy with water, and he seemed exhausted. While he held on to the side of the raft, he could not pull himself up. We tried hard to help him again, but it was in vain. Some while later, he died in the water, and after that, we did let go of him. We were feeling very depressed that there had been no way to save him. Then we concentrated on survival. That there were still SOS signals up in the air helped us tremendously. We handed cigarettes to the smokers, battling to strike the sea matches. Then finally morning dawned. Our spirit immediately rose. We felt that the Navy would not leave us out here without making rescue effort. When two German Fokker Wolf planes circled around us, we were sure that some rescue effort was on its way. Again, as far as the eye could see, SOS signals were visible. We started calculating how long a ship would take from French ports to pick us up. They simply had to come. Later that morning, Liberator bombers crossed over fairly deep and dropped supplies, raising our hope for Allied ships to come and get us. One moment our hope was up, then again we were worried. Somehow on our raft, one managed to help the other. We took turn as lookout. When we rose to the top of the wave, we searched the horizon. The three rafts still drifting together, but we could see others in the distance. The day passed and the sun was again lowering. Then in the late afternoon, our lookout cried, "A ship! A ship!" We first did not believe it, but with the next wave we could see it ourselves. It was coming our way. We could make it out. New strength was in us. We wondered how long it would take to be picked up. The next time we noticed that the ship had altered course and moving away from us. Did she not see us? It was a small ship after all. Then she turned away again, altering course, once in a while to pick up our rafts, which were still all over the sea. We then decided that it was time to use our SOS ammunition. The two rafts near us had run out of it. We gave them some, counted up to three, and then shot together twice in a row. When the ship turned our way again, dawn was setting in, and we set single stars to guide the ship. When it came closer, we could see that a flag was painted on its side. We thought it was a French tricolour. We still had to hang on for an hour until finally it was our turn to be picked up. The ship closed in on us and threw a line. It failed and was thrown again. Again it failed, and someone from the other raft jumped after it. He could not grab it and was too weak to swim. He died when rescue was so close. Finally, one of the rafts was able to tie up the rope and we were pulled in. Rising and sinking our raft, we drifted near the ship. Finally, after two other rafts, it was our turn. we were alongside. Two sailors on the railing grabbed our leading seamen up with him. They grabbed number two and three, then Karsh. When he was pulled up, the raft started capsizing again. There was no counterbalance. While water rushed over me, I raised my arms, totally helpless. But the two men on deck recognized the danger. One heavy man bent forward, grabbed both of my arms, and lifted me up on deck. I tried to stand up, but my knees buckled. He directed me to the after deck. First I crawled, slowly standing up and pulling myself up the stairway. There was a German officer standing beside the bridge. He was in full uniform and asked us to make it for the engine room. We thought at that time that the Germans had rescued us after all. The machine room was unbelievably crowded, but it was warm. We tore off our uniform jackets, the pullovers, the boots, the trousers. Standing, leaning, sitting, wherever there was a little space, there were men everywhere. I did not recognize one, but Karsh was with me. I dropped my clothes on a pile on the after deck and returned to the engine room. Then I sat between the others, just in a shirt, but warm. Slowly I dried and full circulation returned. We just slept or dozed. I have forgotten. Hours later, oranges were passed around. We did not peel them, just broke them open and sipped up the juice. Slowly I realized we had made it. The machine officer was giving signals to us as he could not move around. His language we could not understand. We did not care. After about 28 hours on our raft, we had survived. It was the 29th of December, 1943. When I recovered from the worst exhaustion, I participated in the world again. Word passed around that the ship was Irish. This did not mean much to me, as I did not know Ireland was neutral. But what I did notice was that the crew was friendly. They passed oranges for us as much as we wanted. There was no other food. On the second day, we came out of deck for a funeral of two of the wounded who had died. When finally we reached the port of Cove and we were taking up to the barracks, we did see the little ship on the pier. Unbelievable. How many lives she had saved. Conclusion. I wrote this report during the last days of December 1994 for my friends in Ireland. During this time, my thoughts were going back to World War II. How many lives were lost? Many sailors from both sides had to abandon ship. Some of them were saved, many not. From destroyer Z-27, about 80 sailors were saved, out of a total of 340. None of the officers survived. None of the Luftwaffe personnel. Had it not been for the Kerloch, her captain Tom Donoghue, and her crew of 10, most of the 168 sailors of Z-27 they picked up would not have lived. However, 12 of the crew were saved a day later by a German submarine and by a Spanish naval force ship. They'd stayed on their raft for more than 50 hours. Together with my report, the story of the German Navy personnel interned in Ireland 1944 to 1945. This tells the story how I came to Ireland and how I left it, as old sailors say, with the grace of God. This is a podcast by the National Maritime Museum of Ireland, recorded in February 2026.